Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Wednesday, August 17th, 2016. Jim Morrison and the Doors open our podcast today as we talk about wars among spies.
I'm a spy in the house of love. I know the dream that you're dreaming of.
Well, if you consider Fort Meade, Maryland, the headquarters of the NSA, as the house of love, some spies appear to have hacked into NSA's vaults. Now, it's not clear exactly where this breach occurred. It happened 3 years ago, around the time that Ed Snowden had surfaced. But Snowden is clearly not a suspect in the recently surfacing information about this murky group that calls itself Shadow Brokers. And they have provided some interesting evidence to support their claim that they have become they have come into possession of hacking tools, digital hacking tools, used by the National Security Agency and its highly valued Tailored Access Operations Unit, the TAO. And these are codes that were used by our hackers to hack into servers in other parts of the world. And whoever obtained the source code apparently broke into either the top secret computer servers of the NSA or other servers around the world that the agency would have used to park these files. And the code that was published dates to mid-2013, after Snowden's disclosures. And during that period of time, we're told the NSA spent hundreds of millions of dollars to harden its existing servers and move codes. They may have even changed some passwords like you and I have to all the damn time. And WikiLeaks says that it has a full set of these files, won't say how it obtained them, and threatens to release them in the future. So the shadow brokers have taunted the U.S. spooks with broken English, such as, "We give you some equation group files free," and that it's going to auction off others to cyber warriors around the world. So the Equation Group is a code name that a Russian cybersecurity firm gave to the NSA, and it is believed to reflect what are called the Five Eyes: the U.S., Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, the English-speaking countries that are known to collaborate on surveillance. So we're told this is not a catastrophic leak, but in the big picture, if somebody has obtained this source code, well, they can do a lot of damage. So this is quite a big story, and I'm using multiple sources here to draw on. Here's some of the language from the Equation Group. From Shadow Brokers, talking about the Equation Group. "We auction best files to highest bidder. Auction files better than Stuxnet." That, of course, was the malware that we inserted into the Iranian nuclear program. "The hackers are demanding ransom of 1 million bitcoins, which is about $580 million. "The files and pictures were offered as proof include file names that correspond to those that were mentioned in documents leaked by Snowden, including Banana Glee, Jet Plow, and Epic Banana." I guess they like bananas a lot there at the NSA. "There are also a number of hacking tools used for penetrating network gear, including routers and firewalls, which the NSA has been known to use." So the Kaspersky Lab in Moscow has published a detailed blog post showing a strong connection between the files found in the leak and their earlier findings about the Equation Group. Now, we have to consider the source there. And in this article from The Guardian, it reads, "Although this sounds like a nightmare for NSA, a number of researchers have pointed out it doesn't necessarily mean that the NSA has been hacked directly. There are many different ways that this could have been accessed, and possibly through a weak link in our allies in the so-called Five Eyes. And now I'm referring to coverage from the Washington Post, which writes, the disclosure of the file means that at least one other party, possibly another country's spy agency, has had access to the same hacking tools used by the NSA and could deploy them against organizations that are using vulnerable routers and firewalls. It might also see what the NSA is targeting and spying on. And now that the tools are public, as long as the flaws remain unpatched, other hackers can take advantage of them too. And this is one of the things we know about the NSA. When they get a new router that's been released by Cisco, they send it to their labs, look for the vulnerabilities, so that when it's deployed in the marketplace, that they'll be able to hack into it. And they don't notify Cisco, in this example, hey, you've got a vulnerability there in port 21. And that, of course, can create even greater problems. Here's another quote, as is typical in such cases, the true identity of whoever put the tools online remains hidden. Added to the cache was an auction note that purported to be selling a set of tools to the highest bidders. Attention, government sponsors of cyber warfare and those who profit from it. How much you pay for enemies' cyber weapons? And some former employees suspect the leak was the result of a mistake by an NSA operator, similar to a surgeon leaving an instrument inside the patient after they've sewn it up. let's see. Critics of the NSA have suspected the agency, when it discovers a software vulnerability, this is what I was referring to, frequently does not disclose it, thereby putting at risk the cybersecurity of anyone using that product. So this is a fascinating, stunning, and deeply embarrassing setback for the spooks at Fort Meade. And I'm linking to an article from CNN's Money page, which really provides a lot of good information, and it helps unpack the tweets that Edward Snowden sent from Moscow. And I'm going to run through a couple of them for you because I think this is pretty interesting. The bundle of computer code is about 3 years old, but it's still dangerous since it puts a high-tech military arsenal online within reach of all kinds of criminals. They can use these tools to rob banks, steal government secrets, or expose personal lives. If these digital weapons are found on a computer, that's evidence of an attack, similar to finding fragments of a blown-up missile. And the computer security researchers around the world are now reviewing networks for these tools, and wherever they find this leaked code, they'll know that the NSA has been there. So let me walk you through this, because I find this fascinating. And this verbiage, I'll cite the quotes from Ed Snowden's tweets, but the rest of it is from the author of this article at CNN. To launch an attack, an enemy government wouldn't hit American targets directly. That's too easy to trace. Instead, foreign hackers find a dummy spot to launch their attack. For example, Chinese hackers might slip into a computer server at a company in Peru. Then they'll use that server as a launch pad, sending commands from that computer to break into a U.S. target. It's like China launching a missile at the U.S. from Peru. The job of NSA hackers is to sneak into those enemy launch pad computer servers and scrape off computer code evidence of a breach. Next time that same code is used, the NSA can trace it back to the bad guys. So here's one of the tweets from Snowden. Here's where it gets interesting. The NSA is not made of magic. Our rivals do the same thing to us, and occasionally succeed. And that's an important point because, you know, Obama never talks about cybersecurity except, you know, after the Sony hack, what was that, last year. And we act as if we are invulnerable, except, of course, these occasional hacks that occur, and we act as if we're not doing this to anybody else. But we are, as James Bamford recently told me, the most aggressive cyber warfare nation on the planet. All right, back to the CNN article here. The NSA's job is also to spy on foreign governments, so it, too, launches hacking missions from unsuspecting servers. And foreign governments try to collect evidence of NSA tools to identify that in the future. Again, a Snowden tweet. Knowing this, NSA's hackers at TAO are told not to leave their hack tools on the server after an op. But people get lazy. The NSA's elite hacking team, called Tailored Access Operations, is instructed to always wipe evidence of its presence after a mission. It's like a Navy SEAL team picking up its spent ammunition shells. But sometimes, evidence gets left behind. Another tweet from Snowden. What's new? NSA malware staging servers getting hacked by a rival is not new. A rival publicly demonstrating they have done so is. And that's where we have an important set of speculation here. Because this does appear to be an effort to show that the United States shouldn't push too hard, for example, to blame Russia for the DNC hacks. That's one of the speculations that Snowden offers here in a moment. In fact, here's his next tweet. Why did they do it? No one knows. But I suspect this is more diplomacy than intelligence related to the escalation around the DNC hack. Snowden thinks this NSA tool leak could be a message to the United States. You toy with foreign politics, too. Don't be hypocritical. The next two tweets from Snowden. Circumstantial evidence and conventional wisdom indicates Russian responsibility. Here's why that is significant. Next tweet. This leak is likely a warning that someone can prove U.S. responsibility for any attacks that originated from this malware server. Now, it's pretty ballsy of Ed Snowden, who is living in Moscow at the mercy of Russian authorities, to send a tweet saying that he believes that Russia is responsible for this. So this gets more and more complex all the time. The next tweet here, this leak, this is from Ed Snowden, this leak looks like a somebody sending a message that an escalation in the attribution game could be messy fast. So, and the final tweet here, the CNN author wrote, so ironically, the NSA's response to Snowden's treachery might have actually prevented enemy hackers from continuing to steal NSA tools. His final tweet, you're welcome, NSA. Lots of love. Well, the other hacking news that surfaced in the last 24 hours is that the group called DC Leaks, which is not WikiLeaks, I don't know who they are, they have announced that they have picked up more than 2,500 files related to the billionaire George Soros and his groups, including the Open Society Foundations. And what's interesting here is I picked up coverage of this from The Observer. Now, The Observer is a Trump publication. It is owned by his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. So this article, while it refers to the DC leaks of Soros information, goes on to report absolutely nothing from the leaks. It goes on to report other things that are known in the public domain, that Soros has put $25 million into Democratic elections, including the Clinton campaign. He has funded Media Matters, and it goes on here. But there isn't anything drawn from the leaked files that shows up in this article. So I did a little online search. The New York Times has not covered the Soros hack. I didn't find anything at the Washington Post. In fact, when I did just an ordinary online search, all of the responses that came back were from partisan publications, not from anybody in the mainstream or corporate media. So Linda Lewis, who is a listener, a subscriber, and a whistleblower herself who writes about whistleblower issues, she spent some time diving into these documents, and she sent me a note saying that the Soros Foundation has changed its focus and is reducing funding of whistleblower organizations. And she pulled a paragraph out of one of the reports, and it shows that they are shifting their funding to access to information rather than providing generalized support for watchdog groups. And it says, consequently, they will not renew funding for watchdog organizations inherited from the politicization of science portfolio. This will free up funding for new work. So in some cases, they are cutting funding to the Government Accountability Project, the Project on Government Oversight, and OMB Watch. They don't appear to be eliminating it, but they are reducing it, and they are shifting to groups like the Sunlight Foundation, MapLight, Those are groups that expose money in politics. And I'm not really clear on the strategic ideas behind this, but that's what I've been able to pull up so far. And my thanks to Linda Lewis for sharing her research. Today, actually it was late yesterday, I released a new in-depth interview with Ari Berman, who is a senior writer at The Nation magazine, and he published a book about a year ago called Give Us the Ballot. It's about voting rights in this country and the current struggles over voter suppression efforts by Republicans. And in this excerpt from our in-depth interview, Ari Berman talks about the role of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, in getting multiple states to pass the exact same legislation, which cuts early voting hours, it requires a photo ID, and these are all carefully targeted to limit the participation in elections by mostly Democratic voter groups. Here's Ari Berman.
Well, that's exactly what it was. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, is a group that pairs corporations with state legislatures. They're very influential. And basically, after the Supreme Court upheld Indiana's voter ID law in 2008, ALEC drafted mock voter ID legislation that was then introduced in all of these states following the 2010 election in virtually identical form, whether it was Texas or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania. The bills all look the same. And you don't just suddenly get a situation where 180 new voting restrictions are introduced in 41 states. Someone has to be organizing it. And it was certainly true that this was the strategy that the Republican Party decided to adopt after Barack Obama's election. And instead of trying to reach out to new constituencies, they wanted to instead make it harder for these new constituencies to be able to participate in the political process. And so this was not something that was a grassroots uprising. This was orchestrated at the highest levels of the Republican Party, and certainly an effort that was national in scope and very well organized.
You can hear the full interview with Ari Berman. It's available right now at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker, the Peter B. Collins app, and I'm sure I haven't covered everything. Coming soon, the Peter B. Collins podcast will be available for you on YouTube as a new option. But Ari Berman, who covers these issues in detail, published a new article today at The Nation, and I have linked to it in the show file for this podcast. And what he describes is that North Carolina is fighting hard. The U.S. Court of Appeals rejected their voter suppression laws, saying that they targeted black voters with, quote, almost surgical precision. And after waiting 17 days, they have filed with the U.S. Supreme Court to reinstate the voter ID law, the cuts to early voting, the ban on pre-registration of voters. And they really are pushing hard in this very brazen direction to suppress voter participation. And Berman takes a look at Mecklenburg County in North Carolina, which was carried by Barack Obama by 22 points in 2012. And 70% of African-American voters there use the early voting in that county. So by eliminating early voting, you reduce the likelihood of Democratic voters being able to participate. And here's another stat here. In another county, Watauga County, where the Appalachian State University is located, the Republican-controlled election boards refused to approve a voting site on the campus where 15,000 people voted in 2012, and they had 215 hours of early voting. So if you don't have a place where people can vote, and there's no schedule that makes it convenient for them, you have achieved your goal of reducing participation by targeted groups. Also in North Carolina, they were the first to pass these onerous bathroom laws, pretending to protect people from predatory transgender individuals who are biologically one sex but use the bathroom of the other sex. And this led to an interesting interview that I did this week. It's my new NewsBud interview with Kara Dansky, who is an attorney and a board member of the Women's Liberation Front. And they have strong concerns about the Obama administration's use of Title IX to try to regularize bathroom access. And she raised some other interesting issues, many of which I don't agree with. You can hear that lively conversation and watch it on your telephone or your computer. I'll put a link in the show file for today's podcast at peterbcollins.com. And I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to this podcast, people like Joe Clarici, Brian Mazzi, Andy Krieger, and Benny Alto. They support me every month with a few bucks. And if you're in a position to do that, I don't want to be stealing from your Social Security or taking the money that you use for rent or food. But if you're in a position to support my work, I hope you'll do so. I could use the support to pay our bills and keep this whole thing going. We're doing some web work to launch this new delivery system on YouTube, and that costs money. So if you're in a position to help out, please step on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button and the pull-down, you select Become a Subscriber. There you can choose the level of support you're comfortable with, and the bonus books are there for people who take out a new annual subscription and give me a mailing address in the continental U.S. Last week, I reported that the ACLU had discovered that the FBI was flying surveillance planes over Baltimore during the Freddie Gray protests last year. And if you heard my comments, I raised the questions about whether those FBI planes had surveillance systems in them called Stingray or Dirtbox. And these are the ones that capture cell phone communications by posing as a local cell phone tower. Now, there's an interesting effort to restrict the use of these devices, and it's coming out of the operations of the Baltimore Police Department. Georgetown University's Institute for Public Representation, led by Director Laura Moy, has filed a complaint with the Federal Communications Commission saying that the Baltimore police and other agencies across the country are using these devices without a license from the FCC. Now, by definition, a Stingray or a Dirtbox transmits a signal that causes cell phones to check in with that fake tower. And so a transmission of that sort, under federal law, they argue, requires an FCC license. Now, over at the FCC, an official who requested anonymity said that, well, they don't need a license because they're cops. And, you know, they don't transmit on the wireless spectrum. And they're exempt from the requirement. But she seemed pretty confused based on this account from the Washington Post. So the Justice Department last year did require federal agencies who use the devices to inform judges when they plan to deploy them. That's not the same as getting a warrant. Informing a judge is not the same as getting a warrant, but that policy does not apply to state and local agencies. So I support this effort by the folks at Georgetown University, and I think it's going to be interesting to see if the FCC continues to duck the issue or if it will take a stand. And the FCC official who wouldn't give her name said that they're reviewing the issue. Back in 2014, it warned the public that it's illegal to use a cell phone jammer or any other type of device that blocks, jams, or interferes with authorized communications. And that came after an incident here in San Francisco, in San Francisco, where the subway system, the BART, shut down the cell phone repeaters that they had installed in underground stations, which disrupted the communications of protesters. And that was ultimately exposed, and BART has promised they'll never do it again, and that led to that FCC regulation. Yesterday, I mentioned that the Aetna Health Insurance Company is holding the Obamacare patients it covers hostage, and it's demanding that the Justice Department do an about-face and approve its proposed merger. I think with Humana, if I have that correctly. And I did have wrong information that was in the article that I was quoting from. It said that Aetna said that its losses were $200,000 this year in the, you know, in a recent quarter. And I said, gosh, you know, that's just a couple of paychecks for the CEO. Well, that was incorrect. The actual figure is $430 million they claim they've lost since 2014. Now, one of the things that Aetna doesn't mention is that it has a lot of control over the prices, the rates that it charges for its shitty policies. And they can raise those rates without any interference from Obamacare, the federal government, Health and Human Services, state agencies, or anybody else, because the biggest flaw in Obamacare is it doesn't have any cost controls. So I think this further exposes the extortion attempt by Aetna. And today, a Gallup poll is released that shows well over half of Americans want to replace Obamacare with a single-payer system. 41% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents say that. And nearly 8 in 10 Democrats want to keep the Affordable Care Act in place. Just under three-quarters want to replace it with single-payer. And 59% of Democrats support the idea of both keeping Obamacare and replacing it with single-payer. And our leaders aren't listening to us. This article in the Washington Post offers this opinion. The pragmatic result is stasis, which is what Clinton has embraced. Making the ACA more palatable and expansive instead of restarting the fight she lost while her husband was president. Well, she knows better. I do believe that Hillary understands our health care system quite well. And it's a political calculation that she says, oh, no, single payer. And that is so frustrating and insulting. As is the appointment of Ken Salazar as chair of the transition campaign, the transition to the White House, should Hillary Clinton win in November. And yesterday I gave you partial reasons why progressives are so upset, but Salazar is a big supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He is a defender of fracking for oil and natural gas. Last month, he joined industry supporters in criticizing proposals that Greens want to place on Colorado's November ballot, saying the ill-conceived, vague measures would undermine businesses across the state, damage our economy, and kill jobs. And my friend Norman Solomon is quoted here at Politico, "By choosing Salazar, Clinton has fired a post-convention warning shot at the huge progressive base of the Democratic Party," he said. "If Clinton wants to weasel her way through the TPP issue and set off a war with progressives inside her own party in the process, she's off to a great start." Well, the FBI, following through on a commitment from Director James Comey, has delivered to various congressional committees in the House and the Senate copies of documents related to the investigation of Hillary Clinton's private email server. We're told it includes notes from the 3.5-hour interview with Hillary over the 4th of July weekend, which was conducted without giving her an oath. And they only have notes. They didn't record it. You know, they can't afford a $50 digital recorder there at the FBI. So, and who really wanted to hear verbatim what she had to say when you can read the notes compiled by an FBI agent? Anyway, this could lead to further noise. We know that the House committee chaired by Jason Chaffetz is going to try to bring perjury claims against Hillary Clinton, and I think they have solid grounds to do so. And this is also being criticized by Democrats that this has set a new precedent of turning over documents from an investigation that didn't lead to a prosecution. And over at Judicial Watch, they've announced that the State Department has agreed to disclose emails sent or received by former Secretary Clinton that were uncovered by the FBI in its investigation of the Clinton email system. So this story is still very much alive. Oh, yeah, the Trump campaign, they had a big shakeup. And it really sends a strong message that Trump has selected Steve Bannon, the head of Breitbart News, to become the campaign's chief executive. And he's also promoted a pollster, Kellyanne Conway. And these are people who tell Trump what he wants to hear. "You're brilliant, Donald. There's nobody smarter. And yes, you were sarcastic when you said that Obama founded ISIS." So Bannon has contacts with a lot of the wealthy conservative donors. He's never worked on a political campaign. And he, of course, and the former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, had a bit of a kerfuffle because you may know that a Breitbart reporter who worked for Bannon was roughed up at a after a news conference at a Trump property in Florida. And so maybe this is where Bannon started talking with Trump. I don't really know. But Bannon used to work at Goldman Sachs. He has a background in the military, worked at the Pentagon under President Reagan, and he made a lot of money in the TV and movie business. He owns a piece of the royalties from Seinfeld for some reason, and the right wing describes him as their answer to Michael Moore. He also has close ties to Peter Schweizer, the guy who wrote the book about Clinton Cash and exposed some of the conflicts of interest with the Clinton Foundation. So expect that to be front and center in Trump's comments going forward. We're also learning today just a really disgusting case of back scratching. Chris Christie, who's been cozying up to Trump in a really obscene way, has been exposed because when he became governor of New Jersey, he helped the Trump empire by reducing a $30 million tax bill to $5 million. That's 17 cents on the dollar. And Trump responded by kicking in cash to a foundation called the Drumpf Wackett Foundation, which pays for the governor's residence in New Jersey. And this is reminiscent of the deal that Chris Christie approved when ExxonMobil was responsible for, I think, $6 or $8 billion of cleanup of killing fields in northern Jersey, and he let them off with a fine of like $500,000. So this really is just plain disgusting, and it shows that these Republicans, and yeah, we got to include some Democrats, just think that they can operate with impunity, that nobody will ever catch them in their crony behavior. And it's just really hard to take. Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple Computer, says that he's not going to bring home the $181 billion in profits stashed overseas until he gets a tax rate that he thinks is fair. And he quotes a phony tax rate of 40% in the United States and says that's too high, it's not fair, and so we're not going to bring it back. Well, nobody pays 40%. The stipulated rate, I believe, is 34%. And after deductions and write-downs and all the tax games that they play, most companies pay an effective rate of about 15%. But Tim Cook says that despite this stand, he is not a bad traditional CEO who just cares about money. He loves this country, and he says you can't measure his patriotism by how much Apple pays in taxes. Yeah, right, Tim. Another Silicon Valley angle here, Peter Thiel, the tech billionaire. He's the gay man who spoke at the Republican convention, and he's also the guy who funded the lawsuit that buried Gawker Media. And by the way, Gawker was sold out of bankruptcy yesterday for about $135 million, just $5 million shy of the fine that was imposed in the court case regarding Hulk Hogan's porn tape. And, you know, I find it all pretty bizarre that Peter Thiel would spend his money to bring down Gawker Media because he was offended by the fact that they outed him as a gay man. And he doesn't really acknowledge that as the case. But he published an op-ed in Monday's New York Times embracing a piece of legislation and trying to rename it the Gawker Bill. The legislation in question is called the Intimate Privacy Protection Act, and it's aimed at limiting the release of so-called revenge porn. That's when an ex releases a porn tape with a former lover without that person's permission. And often it's highly embarrassing and, you know, leads to real problems. So Jackie Speier, who's a really fine member of Congress from here in California, she is carrying this bill, the Intimate Privacy Protection Act, and it was drafted in part by a law professor from the University of Miami, Marianne Franks. Franks said, "Well, I was aware of the Gawker litigation, but my drafting efforts were focused primarily on the experiences of everyday victims of so-called revenge porn." And Jackie Speier is politely saying that her bill was not created to address any one case specifically. At the core of my legislation, said Speer, is the critical need for the federal government to deter this destructive conduct and provide victims, no matter who they are, with access to justice. It is not the Gawker bill or the revenge porn bill. Okay. And finally today, Brian Williams is on track for his rehabilitation under the ministrations of the executives at NBC. And he has been earning his way back by fronting some of their primary and convention coverage. I don't think he's a very interesting lead anchor, frankly, but that's what he's been up to. And so now, as part of the transition to recover his reputation after he lied about being under fire in Afghanistan, I think it was, well, Brian Williams is getting a dedicated hourly time slot. He's going to anchor an 11 p.m. Eastern show that will offer news and analysis during the final weeks of the presidential election. Good for you, Brian. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This is the podcast you're free to share with absolutely everyone. So get started right now. Go on to Facebook and share this with five friends, will you? I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.